from KMXT and Kodiak, this is the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Jay Barrett. Coming up this week, Gulf fixed gear fishermen get a surprise cod opening to end the year. It looks like there'll be another herring fishery this spring in Beam Canal, and how sunlight makes spilled oil especially deadly to fish. Coming up on the Alaska Fisheries Report.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, working to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. On the web at alaskaseafood.org.
Some Kodiak fishermen are getting one more shot at some remaining Pacific cod quota. Tom Pearson is a biologist with NOAA Sustainable Fisheries in Kodiak.
There's about almost 1,400 tons, or about 3 million pounds, remaining in the inshore quota for Pacific cod in the central Gulf of Alaska. So we'll open the fishery so the guys will have an opportunity to harvest what remains in the quota.
Pearson says if enough vessels participate, he thinks the 2.8 million pounds can be caught in the time allotted. The four-day fishery will be for fixed gear types only.
By regulation, trawling for peacod has closed for the year, so this would be open to vessels using fixed gear, which would be jig gear, pot gear, or longline gear. The harvest is coming off of the federal quota, but state waters will be open concurrently with federal waters. That's what they call the parallel fishery. So fish that are harvested in state waters will come off of the federal quota during this opening.
Once this in-season action is over, the fixed-gear fishermen will only have a day's rest before having to turn around for the 2012 fishery, which starts for them on January 1st. The trawl fishery for cod begins on January 20th. Pearson says there will be some changes come the new year.
What's going to be different next year is that there's plan amendment to split up the cod quota between different gear types and operational sectors in the central and western Gulf was approved and was implemented. So next year, the hook and line vessels will be competing with other hook and line vessels to catch their allocation of the annual tack.
The central Gulf extends from 147 to 159 degrees west, which is about from the east end of Montague Island to the east side of Aniakchak Bay. The State Department of Fish and Game announced it plans to proceed with another sacro herring fishery in the West Beam Canal this spring. As Deanna Garrison reports, this would be the second commercial sacro herring fishery in 36 years.
Fish and Game estimates 7,915 tons of herring will return to the West Beam Canal area this spring. Of that, seiners will be allowed to harvest a total of 758 tons. Fish and Game Commercial Fisheries Management Biologist Scott Walker.
There's still a lot of questions about how strong the market will be and that sort of thing, but that's where we are right now. Our plan is to have a fishery. Our plan is to allow the purse seine fishermen to harvest that.
The fishery alternates between purse seiners and gill netters. The guideline harvest level for West Beam this past spring was significantly higher at 1,276 tons. A total of four gill netters actually participated in the 2011 fishery. It was the first time the fishery was held in West Beam in 35 years.
It wasn't very successful last year. Last year it was the gillnet fleet's turn. They were given the first ability to fish by regulation. And so this year, after the gillnetters fishing last year, that brings the purse seine fleet into their year. And so here we are.
With an even lower GHL this year, Walker isn't sure what kind of participation to expect from the seine fleet.
The way that it's divided up right now, regulations require us to divide it up into an equal share quota, and that leaves 15.8 tons per permit, which isn't very much fish for an individual vessel at the prices and the market the way it is right now.
There are a total of 48 Southeast Sacro seine permits eligible to fish West Beam Canal.
Last year's herring fishery was a complete flop.
That's Andy Rawolf, a vocal opponent of the West Beam herring fishery, a member of the Ketchikan Herring Action Group. He says commercial fishermen should not be targeting herring in that area.
The reason we're opposed to it is that there's several hundred lodge owners, bed and breakfast, charter boaters, salmon fishermen, commercial and sport fishermen, that depend on the salmon and the halibut and everything else that feed on those herring throughout each year. We're talking about millions of dollars of revenue in this area that depend on a healthy ecosystem in West Beam Canal, and they're targeting the bottom of the food chain.
Rawlf says he would like to see the fishery managed more conservatively to allow the herring stocks in West Beam to further rebound. Ron Porter is the fleet manager for EC Phillips. He says Fish and Game has protected the stocks and is managing the fishery responsibly.
The fishery has a 6,000-ton threshold, which the departments met, went over this thing time and time again with good scientific data. And as long as the stock has 6,000 tons in it, they feel that that's ample for spawning and to keep the stock moving ahead. And obviously that's what's going on.
Porter says he expects the 2012 Sacro herring fishery will be more successful than last year's. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
You're listening to the Alaska Fisheries Report. Hear the whole show online anytime at kmxt.org.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you by commercial fishermen for Bristol Bay, permit holders and fishing groups standing together to protect and enhance the renewable fishing jobs and businesses of the Bristol Bay region.
A study published this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences has shown that spilled oil and fish embryos really do not mix, especially when sunshine is added to the equation. Scientists with NOAA, Bodega Marine Lab, and the Washington State Department of Fish and Wildlife studied the effects of the 2007 Costco Busan oil spill in San Francisco Bay on herring. They found that chemicals in the bunker oil reacted with sunlight and caused herring embryos to literally fall apart before they hatched. John Incardona, a toxicologist with NOAA Fisheries in Seattle, said the study was based on what scientists learned from the Exxon Valdez oil spill. However, they found a key difference. EVOS involved 11 million gallons of crude oil, while the Costco Busan spill was comprised of 54,000 gallons of bunker oil. They expected heart problems in the herring, but instead found the fish embryos were disintegrating. They suspect something in the bunker oil made the fish embryos highly sensitive to the sun.
For example, there are some drugs that if somebody takes a drug and then goes out in the sun, they can get a bad skin reaction. Well, that's in essence what we think happened with this bunker oil, and we've done laboratory studies to show that the residual fuel oils have some chemical constituent in it that when it's taken up by something translucent, like a fish embryo, there's a reaction with the sunlight that then produces oxidation, free radicals, things that then actually damage the tissues and causes the animal to, in essence, just fall apart.
Bunker oil is a mixture of diesel fuel and residual fuel oil, but Incardona says the exact chemical in it that causes the photosensitivity is not known.
So chemically, it's highly concentrated stuff, you know, that's not taken out of crude oil from the refining process. And it turns out that something that we don't know exactly what it is. The chemists, again, because oil is so complicated, it's thousands and thousands of individual chemicals. We don't know exactly what it is, but it produces what's called phototoxicity.
The scientists suspect an interaction with the sun because the effects on herring were only on eggs laid near the surface. Eggs lower down in the murky San Francisco Bay water column did not show the same damage. Bunker oil powers most of the large container ships that ply the world's sea lanes, including the Great Circle Route from Asia to the lower 48 that passes through the Aleutian Chain. Given how many ships use bunker oil, spills are more common and widespread than large crude oil spills. Incardona says even relatively small spills, like the one in San Francisco, could be very damaging to sea life. The Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute is looking for Alaskan chefs to compete in the Great Alaska Seafood Cook-Off, a preliminary round of the Great American Seafood Cook-Off. Contestants will have an hour to prepare a dish highlighting Alaska seafood. The statewide winner will be sent to New Orleans later in the year to compete against the best chefs in the nation. The Great Alaska Seafood Cook-Off isn't until mid-May, but ASME is looking for contestants now. You can find more information at greatalaskaseafoodcookoff.com.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by Alaska Boats and Permits, marine broker for vessels, permits, and IFQs. 1-800-992-4960 or online at alaskaboat.com.
Some seafood sold in the Pacific Northwest is not what it seems. Mislabeled fish is more common than you might think. according to the few cops trying to make sure customers get the species they paid for. Now those who are on patrol are looking for higher penalties to deter fish cheaters. Northwest News Network correspondent Tom Bonsi reports from Seattle.
Washington Fish and Wildlife Officer Eric Olson trained to become a game warden, but his job has also turned him into a seafood connoisseur.
Yeah, see that spot pattern?
Uh-huh.
See how it's just one after another? See that? It's just...
Light of corn?
Yeah, that is not...
On a recent morning, Olson drops in unannounced at the seafood counters of half a dozen stores and markets in Seattle.
Right.
He's on the lookout for misbranded fish, which he can sometimes spot with the naked eye. Other times, it takes a lot more sleuthing.
It's kind of hard when it doesn't have the head on it and everything else.
Funny business on the label is also a tip-off. At an Asian market, the manager gets a gentle scolding for omissions.
I know that it's probably farm-raised, okay, Atlantic salmon, but you need to actually say that on there.
Oh,
okay.
So say on the label, you're saying?
Correct.
Okay.
Okay, on the label that actually, so the consumer can make an informed decision.
Olson could write a ticket, but the contrite manager gets off with a verbal warning. The officer saves his ire for bigger fish, you might say.
Quite honestly, all this stuff is always about the money. It's always about the bottom line.
The ill-gotten profit comes from misbranding farmed salmon as more expensive wild-caught, or swapping among species, say, sockeye for king, or a switcheroo like cheap imported Greenland turbot for Pacific halibut. Those are all examples of ripoffs that state or federal agents have busted in this region.
Can you get the manager for me?
Olson figures about 15% of seafood in the marketplace is masquerading as something other than what it actually is. His is in the middle range of various estimates. For the past 3 years, a University of Washington Tacoma environmental scientist has assigned students to run DNA tests on salmon sold at retail and in South Puget Sound restaurants. Professor Erica Klein says more than a third, 38% of the restaurant samples came back as a different species than what the menu said.
So that was the really high shocker.
By contrast, Klein says the vast majority of tested grocery stores were honest.
You know, there could be a number of things going on there. I think grocery stores probably are mostly larger chains and are pretty heavily scrutinized.
Klein says once a filet is cooked and sauced in a restaurant, it's hard to prove fraud without a DNA test. Klein says when she dines out, she asks about where the fish came from. If she gets a dodgy answer, she orders something else. In Washington State, the deputy chief of the Fish and Wildlife Police is looking for a legislator who will champion higher penalties. Mike Sensi says seafood mislabeling is currently a misdemeanor with a maximum $200 fine for the first offense. I'm Tom Bonsi in Seattle.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is supported in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by the Pebble Partnership, listening before we act. Find out more at pebblepartnership.com.
And that's all for this last edition of the Alaska Fisheries Report for 2011. We had help this year from Rosemary Alexander, Len Anderson, Tom Bonsi, Dan Bross, Jennifer Canfield, Libby Casey, Dave Donaldson, Maria Dudzak, Daisha Eaton, Jacqueline Estes, Deanna Garrison, Brianna Gibbs, Tony Gorman, Alexandra Gutierrez, Steve Heimel, Ann Hillman, Shane Iverson, Esme Joyce, Melody Kay, Casey Kelly, Lorelei Kaneen, Patrice Cole, Matt Lichtenstein, Wesley Loy, Marsha Lynn, Stephanie Mangini, Mike Mason, Matt Miller, Ed Ronco, John Sacton, Ed Schoenfeld, Aaron Selbig, Ben Stanton, Joe Vicnicki, Maggie Wall, Lainey Welch, Paul Ed Wellington, Robert Woolsey, and Sam Wright. The show and the awards it's won this year are a direct result of the great work these journalists share with us every week. I can't thank them enough, though they all will be getting 2012 KMXT calendars in the mail soon. In Kodiak, I'm Jay Barrett, wishing you a Happy New Year.